White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to episode 44 of the International Jews Study Hour on this Thursday, April 25th, 2013. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and
I'm Hadding Scott.
And we're going to do things a little differently tonight. Instead of reading the next chapter in The International Jew, we will devote the program to the 100th anniversary of the murder of 13-year-old Mary Fagan on April 26, 1913, at the hands of her Jewish employer, who still today is claimed to be innocent of the crime and found guilty by a jury only because of rampant anti-Semitism existing in the South at that time. You hear the similarity of this to what we read in the International Jew every week is why we're doing this on this program tonight, and also because the anniversary is tomorrow, and this is the closest we could come to it. And, you know, a 100th anniversary is pretty important. And the fact is the Jews are making it very important also. So we had to be aware of this. This is a clear example, this what's going on with the Leo Frank trial 100 years later, is a clear example of the kind of Jewish interference with justice and the rights of others, of rights of non-Jews that we read, as I already said, in the pages of the International Jew every week. If we had to put the whole project of Jewry into one sentence, this is, in my opinion, Hadding, and you can give yours, but it could be something like to prevent and deflect criticism of Jews in all the places where they live, which is everywhere, by designating it as bigoted hatred for Jews, which they call anti-Semitism, and for no other reason. Therefore, convincing as many people as possible that anti-Semitism not only exists, that, you know, what they want to do is convince as many people as possible that anti-Semitism exists, and but that it's a huge problem or a serious problem for everyone. And this is then the goal of much of their work, to convince everybody in the world that anti-Semitism is a problem. What do you think, Hanning?
I think being immune to criticism is definitely a major goal of theirs. And when I get into arguments with people, I make that point often. I say, I just think that Jews ought not to be immune to criticism. The fact that they're able to make themselves immune to criticism in various ways, through various methods, allows them to get away with a lot, as you might expect for anybody that could be immune to criticism.
Yeah, and I think that's the purpose. I have that coming up. But that's the purpose, is so that they are allowed to get away with all they get away with, because they have a lot that they know they want to get away with. They know what they are. So anyway, an example that just came up yesterday, and you know, these things appear every day in the news about anti-Semitism now. Well, I guess they come to me because I'm on a list that somebody posts everything that, you know, is posted about in the Jewish newspapers, you know, of this nature. So I see them all. But just yesterday, they had the story, or maybe it was 2 days ago, the story was in Australia. The Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, who is a Jewess, as I understand it, signed the London Declaration on Combating Anti-Semitism. She did that on Tuesday, 2 days ago, and this made big news in the Jewish press, you know, and it's a declaration that was first adopted in 2009 by 125 legislators from more than 40 countries. But this first annual conference was the Interparliamentary Coalition for Combating Anti-Semitism. It was just some conference that Jews got together in London, England, so they could call it the London Conference or the London Declaration, you know, and sound real official, like it's British or something. They, you know, and they can form conferences as often as they want. They get, these Jews will travel, you know, internationally. They'll fly from wherever they have the money, or somebody will give them the money, and they're all big names, and they get together and they do these things. So in 2009, they had this one, and they named it the London Declaration, that they decided that there needed to be more emphasis on combating anti-Semitism. So now they can put this in the news whenever they want, along with all the other stuff they put in the news, along the same lines. And it says, they say in here, no, this, I have to read this, Danny Lamb, who was the, because I'm not just wasting time here, but this sets up how they operate and why they do what they do. This Danny Lamb, who's president, executive council of Australian Jewry president, he was there, of course, at the signing, and he had to make a statement, which they publish. He says, Australia, as a respected nation around the world, in joining this London Declaration, can only help in our battle against anti-Semitism. We are very grateful to the Prime Minister for making the declaration. And then Gillard did not, I don't know how you pronounce your name, Gillard, did not speak at the signing, but her office released a statement. And here again, it's the usual stuff. Here's what they said. Anti-Semitism did not end with the conclusion of the Second World War and the fall of Nazism. It did not end with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's what the UN came, the United Nations came up with, I think in the 50s or about that time, to do this. And it did not end with the foundation of the State of Israel, as though it was supposed to. You know, now the Jews have a place of their own to go, so they don't have to, you know, stay around in other countries where the people don't like them. But do they go there? No, they don't go there. She finishes off by saying it pollutes our world right now. So, in other words, it's all anti-Semitism for the Jews is always going to be in the world. Nothing ever gets rid of it. And why not? Because the Jews are continually creating it by living among other people. And so this is a permanent campaign against anti-Semitism. They say they want to get rid of it, but it's never ending. They know it. We need to know it. You see, the problem is we don't know it. They know what they're doing. We don't know what they're doing, and we need to know. I hope these programs help to teach us. Now, don't have enough people that hear them, though. You know, we need to get them out and about to people who might learn something from it. Now, I was going to say that the purpose of the scam, and then I'll be done, Hattie. The purpose, I mean, the goal is to stop, you know, criticism. The purpose of stopping criticism is to cover for their criminality, just like Leo Frank's criminality, and to allow them to get away with this inherent hatred they have of whites in the form of crimes against us. And let's see, in the form of secret but total control over our societies, which they don't want us to realize that they're doing. And they want us to, they put out that they are victims of bigotry. And Henry Ford's International Jew covers this more clearly in more detail than anything I have ever seen. Now, do you know of anything else that does as good a job as the International Jew on exposing this, Hattie?
Well, I thought that, you know, I think there's a lot of room for improvement with the International Jew, since it relies so heavily on quotes from the protocols, which I think are not genuine. So there's a lot of room for improvement. I think William Pierce's Who Rules America did a good job of taking one theme of the International Jew and bringing it up to date, and also leaving out the flaky stuff, the protocols.
You know what, Hanning, I have to say that the protocols play a role in a certain part of the International Jew, and where they're actually going into them. And then they're mentioned here and there. But basically what I'm thinking about is how they go from one area to another and talk about how the Jews tried to take it over, did take it over, how they handled it, you know, and how they grew in power. And they do this in chapter after chapter after chapter. And I think it's very instructive. You know, it shows us the wide range in which they're functioning. I don't think anything's taught me as much as the International Jew. Although I know that one article by, you know, well, Pierce wrote a lot of good stuff, but it's not quite in the same type. And this goes back to that time too, the earlier period where this was strong. We kind of get an understanding from 1900 on, of how they were doing this. It wasn't just recently, you know. So anything else?
Well, you asked me if there was anything that does the job better than the International Jew. I mean, it's hard
to say. Or as good as. Yeah, I just thought you might come up with something. I don't really know because I don't know everything. But I, you know, everything that's been written. But I just, for me, this is the best thing that I know of.
It's hard for me to think of anything like that.
Yeah, right. Well, another point to be made before we get into this is that the B'nai B'rith decided to form a special attack and defend arm of their organization, which became the Anti-Defamation League. And I think it was in October of 1913. And I think it was because of the charges against this Leo Frank and the nature of the charges, how serious it was and how it was becoming well known outside of the South. And that just got them to do it right away, although they say they did it for other reasons. But, you know, 6 months after the murder of this girl and the arrest, and he was already on trial, started in July or something like that, they then formed this league. And they have a lot to say about it, too. And here's the thing, too, that I know, you know, that everybody might not know that Leo Frank had been elected president of B'nai B'rith, the Atlanta Gate City Lodge, his local lodge, with about 500 members in the autumn of 1912. And less than 1 month after his sensational trial concluded in the summer of 1913, in open defiance of his guilty verdict, he was unanimously reelected by his lodge members.
Wow.
So while he was in prison, the whole time he was in prison, he remained president and he was acting as president. And they were, you know, cooperating with him and they were standing up for him. And he was doing his job, you know, as president of that lodge. Isn't that strange?
That's the kind of thing that provoked some anti-Jewish reaction in Georgia at the time.
Mm-hmm.
There hadn't been any bias against Jews in Georgia until the Leo Frank case. I have some information.
Yeah, why don't you go into that now?
All right. Okay. Although the Anti-Defamation League today and various Jew-friendly documentaries, like one produced by PBS, like to claim that Leo Frank was a victim of anti-Semitism, there was no particular anti-Semitism in Georgia prior to the Leo Frank case. After Governor Jack Slayton commuted Frank's sentence under charges of conflict of interest because he was involved in a law firm that was defending Frank, he went to New York City. Governor Jack Slayton went to New York City where he was interviewed by the New York Times. Slayton was asked if prejudice against Jews had influenced the proceedings against Leo Frank. And Slayton said that this was not the case. This is from the New York Times of the 30th of June, 1915. No race prejudice. New York Times asks, do you think the question of race prejudice had anything to do with the case against Frank? And Governor Slayton says, no, you will find prejudice against foreigners on the part of some people in Georgia, just as you will find the same thing in New England, here in New York, or anywhere else. Georgia is as human as any state in the Union. Is there any prejudice against Jews in Georgia as a result of the Frank case? I answer that question by pointing to the fact that one of the trustees of the colony of Georgia under Oglethorpe was Minas, a Jew, whose descendants to this day are among the best and most highly respected of Georgians. The head of the Education Board of Atlanta is a Jew, and so is the vice president of the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce. My own law partner, Mr. Phillips, is a Jew. So says Slayton. Some of the best of Georgians are Jews. Okay, Slayton didn't really answer that second question, but it gives additional evidence that there really wasn't much prejudice against Jews in Georgia until the Frank case. And there's another interview in the New York Times with Slayton's successor as governor, Nathaniel Harris. And this appeared in the New York Times on the 20th of August, 1915. The New York Times correspondent told Governor Harris that Georgia had shocked the Union. And Governor Harris responded, "I know it," said the governor. "This awful horror hurts the state, but I don't think the North has had the right idea about the feeling against this dead man. It was not for the reasons that have been given for it. It was not because he was a Jew. There was never any anti-Jewish feeling in Georgia until now. It was because, in the first place, there is something that unbalances men here in the South where women are concerned. I won't call it chivalry or call it anything. It is, if you like, something that destroys a man's ability and even willingness to do cold and exact justice. I've been a lawyer for over 40 years and have had many cases in the courts, and I have found that where a woman is the plaintiff, she will get twice the damages a man would get who had the same case. That is the way it is in the South. Go. Let a strong man make use of his strength to force a helpless woman to yield to him, and there is something that arouses the tiger in Southern men." Mm-hmm. Now, that is the first thing. But there was another thing that roused the bitterness against Frank, and it was outside interference. From all over the Union, there came an attempt to govern Georgia's action. Detectives were sent here, petitions circulated, resolutions passed, attacks made upon the state. Whether it should have aroused resentment may be a question, but that it did, there is no question whatsoever.
Well, there's a real excellent example of how Jews are the ones who create anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
By all their actions there connected to that trial and that Leo Frank,
yeah.
All this anti-Semitism that didn't exist.
Yeah, I've got more from
okay.
From
yeah,
Harris.
Keep going. And when did he say these things? What year?
August 1915.
Oh, okay.
These are two things that in the first place created anger against Frank. The correspondent says, "Not among the ignorant classes, surely. They don't read papers from other states." And Governor Harris says, "But they learned what those papers were saying. What was said outside of the state was commented on by the papers here, and Tom Watson in his weekly published parts of the original criticisms, whether correctly quoted or not, I do not know. All classes in Georgia knew what was being said and done and knew of the organized efforts to set Frank free. And every one of these efforts deepened the feeling against him."
Mm-hmm.
"You said a while ago that there had never been any anti-Jewish feeling in the state until now," said the correspondent. "Is there now?" "I am afraid there is," said the governor reluctantly. "But I hope it is only a flurry and will pass away. It is among the more thoughtless of our people. There has never been an atom, never a trace or a thought of it. The Jews have always been our friends. We have here the best class of Jews. For a man to be known as a Jew was actually an asset to him in a business way. But among the thoughtless elements there has grown up, temporarily, I hope, a feeling that the Jews banded themselves together as a race or a religion to save a criminal, and out of that has grown a feeling of hostility. You would not believe the tremendous extent of the influence that was exercised by a report that spread from one end of the state to the other, and was believed by thousands of people. It was said that the Jews had said that no Jew had ever been hanged and that none ever would be. All right? So that's Governor Slayton and his successor, Governor Harris, both saying that there was no tradition of anti-Jewish feeling in Georgia. And Harris saying that it cropped up because of the way Jews behaved during the Leo Frank case. This means that the Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith and all the other people that go along with their story are full of hogwash.
Well, right. And just to give some of these examples real quick, because I do have those here. You know, the Abraham Foxman on the ADL website, he's got his little thing there about this trial, and it says there, "Hang the Jew, hang the Jew." This was the cry of the furious mob outside the Atlanta courthouse where Leo Frank, a Northern Jew, stood trial after his arrest, you know, for the murder, blah, blah. For the murder he did not commit, they say. Anti-Semitism hung heavy in the courtroom as Frank was found guilty and sentenced to death. And then Dinnerstein, that Leonard Dinnerstein, I don't have that right here. I have to go scroll down where I do have it. But he also wrote in this book, he wrote one of the most highly read books about the Leo. It's called The Leo Frank Case. Of course, he's Jewish. And he did it started it as a dissertation for his PhD at Columbia. And it turned into a book, and he then became what was supposed to be an expert on Leo Frank. But he also wrote that, he says, beyond the main testimony, the jurors had little more on which to base their decision than hearsay, rumors, and unsubstantiated accusations, which is not really true. Yet most members of the public were thoroughly convinced of the defendant's guilt and made their voices heard. The intense summer heat necessitated that the courtroom windows be left open and remarks from the crowds could be heard easily by those inside. "Crack the Jew's neck! Lynch him!" were some of the epithets emerging from the more boisterous. Threats were also made against the jury, he wrote, that they would be lynched if they did not hang that damn Sheeny. Now, this is all lies because, for one thing, there are three Georgia newspapers, the largest newspapers in Georgia, that covered that trial like, you know, you wouldn't believe what they say, and they are competing with one another. They are there all every day, outside, inside, and none of them reported a single thing like this. And also in the court documents that went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court, because Frank did take his case that far, and the United States Supreme Court found that there was nothing improper in the trial, and the sentence, they held the sentence to be okay. There was nothing in those court documents that said anything about this kind of behavior influencing the jury, you know, because they could hear these things from outside. So this is all lies. And it's just so typical of how far these Jews go, but they get a lot of people to believe them, and that's all they care about. They don't care if they're found, if they're seen as liars by a few. They care that they can get a whole lot of people to believe what they say, and they do manage to do that, I think.
Well, it's possible that somebody said hang the Jew at some point, but I think that Frank's Jewishness was something that Jews themselves made into an issue by the way they rallied around him.
Well, yeah, sure, because the people probably wouldn't have done it. And it is true about the South, and even today the South, people in the South are too Jew-friendly from what we've learned to know about this, about Jews. You know, I mean, I'm clearly anti-Semitic, but they, you know, so I see that they don't want to be still, much more than other parts of the country. They're very, very Jew-friendly in the South.
Yeah, these premillennialist churches are very pro-Israel.
Well, I don't think it's just that. I think they had this thing against, they're fighting the Negro, the rise of the Negro, and didn't see the Jew as an enemy at all.
That's right.
And there's a lot of them. There's a lot of change now because there's certainly elements, but still we do find, because What I see is that in a lot of these pro-white organizations in the South, they're not very anti-Jewish. So
you can also find evidence of positive regard for the South among Jews prior to the Frank case. A lot of the coon songs and Southern regional songs that were in style back at that time were written by Jews. People may not know what I'm talking about, but if you get interested in 78 RPM records from the first couple of decades of the 20th century, which I have a collection of, you'll see that there's a whole genre of music that deals with Southern themes. And a lot of it was written by Jews on Tin Pan Alley. They were really into that stuff back then.
Mm-hmm. Well, so much of our popular music was written by Jews. I don't even like to think about it. Well, anyway, to go on then, did you have more about that, Hanning?
Well, I just want to say, I think it would be very hard to find a case of a Jew even being lynched in the South ever prior to the Frank case, and even apart from the Frank case, apart from, you know, Schwerner and Goodman in the 50s. I spent a few minutes trying to find on Google Books and news search, trying to find an example of another Jew that got lynched, and I couldn't find one that was identified as such. I mean, I didn't spend a huge amount of time looking, but I thought I could easily find one, and I couldn't.
Well, that shows that they didn't hang Frank because he was a Jew, like the Jews today want to say. You know, that wasn't the reason they lynched him. You know, it wasn't because he was a Jew. It was because he was guilty and he was getting away with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, this whole business with Slayton, well, I'm going to lose my place altogether if I go hunting around for different things. So I'll just say that it seems like next would be good to say that, that this, as has already been intimated, this became an international cause célèbre. First, it was a cause célèbre for the in the United States, and it was created by the American Jewish community, and then it became international, and there were rumors about Jewish groups throughout major European cities like Paris, and remember the Alliance Israelite Universelle, that they naturally would have gotten involved in it, and even far off Moscow, organizing and agitating. Now, that was 1913 to 15, so in Moscow it fits. So organizing and agitating locally on Frank's behalf to bring, here's how they put it, to bring awareness to his plight and predicament. It's always it. They, you know, this stuff they say, oh, we have to bring awareness to what's being done to Jews, this anti-Semitism going on. And as you mentioned, Adolf Oakes offered his New York Times printed a lot of these articles that the Jews wanted printed. And this was the same time that the New York Times was also printing appeals for money for starving, dying Jews in Eastern Europe and Russia. You know, they're always using that 6 million number. And they were also printing these appeals about Leo Frank that the Jews wanted to put in there. And, of course, they still do that kind of thing today for the Jews. But then we have that in the trial documents, and going, it went to the Georgia Supreme Court, it went to the United States Supreme Court, and nothing was ever overturned. So it was, you know, it was a well done trial. There's nothing wrong with the trial.
Yes,
and it's held all this time.
I read one article. It was urging that Leo Frank be spared, some northern newspaper. And it referred to the Supreme Court's review of the case. There were two dissenters out of whatever number of Supreme Courts there were at the time who upheld the status of Leo Frank. And the argument for throwing out the case against Frank was that he hadn't been present when the verdict against him was read in the courtroom.
Oh, God.
That was the basis of the argument.
And he wasn't present because he didn't want to be or something like that, wasn't it? I mean,
I'm not sure about that, but it had something to do with the fact that there was a crowd of people outside the courtroom and allegedly it would be unsafe. I'm not sure who decided that it would be unsafe.
Yeah, probably him and his lawyers or something. And he probably didn't want to be there.
Possibly.
Now I'm looking for this, now, why don't I know where this is? I'm looking for this thing about, when this pardon. I think this is a good place to go into this pardon. Oh, here it is, way up at the top. Okay, under Alonzo Mann. Well, after that, we'll talk about Alonzo Mann. But, you know, then the Jews never gave up on this. This is to me what's the most important part. How they don't give up. This one man, they can't allow this one man to be guilty of his crime. They have to convince the world that he was, you know, a victim of anti-Semitism. He didn't do it. So you have, they worked and worked on getting Georgia to pardon Leo Frank. And they put through the first one of three Jewish organizations petitioned the state, and they studied it all and everything. But their petition was denied in 1983, December 1983. So this is how, you know, how long later they were still working on this. And they still are. You know, well, let me just continue here. So then 3 years later, they never quit, you know. They never say they've been defeated. They just keep working on it. So 3 years later, were still working on it. And they managed to get a pardon. And a pardon, though, that did not exonerate Frank. Not that kind of a pardon, but just a pardon because they said because he was lynched, you know, by a mob, and the mob was the perpetrators were never brought to justice, which they never did. And even though they know now who a lot of them are, I don't know if they knew then that somebody knew, but they didn't do anything about it. So so that is all to the shame of Georgia, and because of that. You know, they were going to give this pardon to please the Jews. And the Jews are happy with it. Because even though it's not a pardon that says, we think we want to, you know, undo the verdict, they don't undo the verdict. They don't say he's not guilty, but they just say that there was some problems and the state failed to protect him. As it should have, and so therefore. And so now Jews in their press, they constantly say that Frank was pardoned, but they don't tell you the rest of it, that what kind of a pardon it was. And this is how the Jews managed to get something, you know, that's just in words only or some word they can use. And they know how, you know, just one word that they can use, without saying the rest of it, they will take that and then they will convince people that this guy was pardoned. So that's the story on that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, you want to talk about Alonzo Mann now?
Yeah.
Okay. Alonzo Mann was Leo Frank's office boy who made a revelation 69 years after the event that was supposedly evidence to exonerate Leo Frank. According to Tom Watson Brown, who was a prominent Georgia attorney, a graduate of Harvard Law School, and a native of Marietta, Georgia.
And he was the populist, wasn't he?
Well, Tom Watson was the journalist that had the hillbilly...
Oh, two different people.
...weekly hillbilly newspaper that was quite... involved in agitating against Frank, Tom Watson. But this is Tom Watson Brown, who evidently was named after him.
Oh.
And he was an attorney who graduated from Harvard Law School and was a native of Marietta, Georgia, and was involved in some major legal dealings in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book called Notes on the Case of Leo Max Frank and Its Aftermath, which can be found on archive.org. This is what Tom Watson Brown says. The affidavit produced in March of 1982 by 83-year-old Alonzo M. Mann truly beggars belief. Mann was an office boy working in Leo Frank's second floor office at the time of the murder and was called as a defense witness during Frank's murder trial. Mann testified at that trial that he worked with Frank in the latter's office during the morning of the April 26, 1913 murder and left the office at 11:30 a.m. He also testified as to his belief in Frank's good character. Of course, Mann's affidavit does not rise to the dignity of the trial testimony of Jim Conley, which it is apparently intended to challenge. Conley testified under oath, pursuant to examination by the prosecution attorneys, and was vigorously cross-examined for some 3 days by the very capable lead attorneys for Frank's defense team. Trial observers and counsel for both prosecution and defense agreed that Conley's testimony had not been broken by the cross-examination. It was a critical element among many in corroborating the circumstantial evidence and other evidence leading to Frank's conviction. Among the questions which are raised by Mann's affidavit of 1982 are, why has he come forward only at this late date, 1982? He was interviewed in 1913 by the Atlanta police investigating the crime and by defense counsel for Frank. If he had any information to shed on the crime, such as he now purports to set forth in his affidavit, would it not have been extracted by skilled interrogators from a 14-year-old boy? Would he not have volunteered it at that time? Mann's assertion that he was afraid of Conley and Conley's purported threat to kill him if he revealed what he saw that day hardly merits belief. Conley was arrested on the Tuesday after the crime, despite Frank's efforts to shield him, and remained in jail from that day throughout the trial, and for a year after his own conviction for being an accomplice after the fact in Mary Fagan's murder, leaving Mann in complete safety. In addition, Conley died in 1962, a fact which must have been known to Mann, hence why his silence for the following 20 years. Mm-hmm. Likewise, Mann's assertion that his mother's admonition to say nothing about what he had seen seems most unlikely to be followed by any 14-year-old youth with the slightest semblance of conscience. Concealing evidence in a murder trial is, of course, a crime in itself. Mann purported to have a regard for Frank, and after Frank's conviction, if not before, surely he would have come forward with whatever favorable evidence he had. In addition, Atlanta was covered by agents and operatives on behalf of Frank's defense before, during, and for many months after the trial, seeking out any scrap of information pertaining to the crime and Frank's conviction. Large sums of money were expended in this process. Rewards were offered and promises made. Again, it cannot be believed that Mann would not have come forward during these well-publicized searches.
Well, Mann and let me just throw in here, maybe you're going to add this, but you know, I read also that, it was not believable that his mother and father, or his mother maybe, I think you said his parents, told him not to say a word because they were afraid of this Jim Conley who told this kid that he was going to kill him if he said anything. Well, they said in this society, you weren't afraid of a black man, if you had information about a crime and so on, and especially a black man who had killed a white woman. You know, so there's this idea that he should be afraid, his parents should be afraid for him, doesn't hold water for that time and place.
Yeah. I think that's why Frank thought he could have Conley as an accomplice in the crime, and that Conley wouldn't say anything either, because Frank would just say that Conley did it, and who would take Conley's word as a Negro Frank?
That's right. Negroes were not thought to be honest, and the fact is they weren't. I mean, I suppose some were, but this guy, this Conley, turned out to be quite dishonest. He was always telling some different story, and then he even admitted, told him one time that he was a big liar. But anyway, continue. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Back to Tom Watson Brown. Mann asserts that he saw Conley on the first floor of the building, between the elevator shaft and the trap door to the basement, carrying a female body. Mann places himself between Conley and the front door, which afforded him a ready way of escape. Mann knew that Frank was, or should have been, upstairs in the second floor office at the time. He also knew workmen were in the building on the upper floors, all affording ready means of assistance to him and to the victim. In addition, the streets outside the factory were teeming with the thousands of people who had assembled to watch the Confederate Memorial Day parade, which Mary Fagan had herself intended to observe. Mann had only to retrace his few steps to the front door and sound the alarm to produce numbers of rescuers who would have been more than eager to mete out punishment to Conley for what was at that time the most heinous offense in Georgia moral structure, the rape and murder of a white girl by a black male. Could any 14-year-old boy in the Atlanta of 1913 be so craven or frightened as to not, even if he did not seek to help the victim personally, cry out for assistance from any of these sources? To pose the question is to answer it. In short, Mann's affidavit lacks credibility. Perhaps of greater significance is that Mann's recitation of the scene that he saw, that is, Jim Conley carrying the body of a girl toward the trap door leading to the basement, is not inconsistent with the prosecution's case on which Frank's conviction was based, that is, that Frank waited for Mary Fagan to appear in his office for her pay, lured her into the metal room, assaulted her there, struck and killed her when she resisted his advances, and subsequently called for Conley to come to the second floor, collect her body, and remove it to the basement for incineration or later removal. If the scene that Mann now asserts took place, it varies from the prosecution's case so insignificantly as to be not worthy of any motion to this board for a new review of Frank's case, much less a posthumous pardon. In particular, it does not explain away all those other factors which pointed to Frank's guilt. Okay, that was Tom Watson Brown.
Okay, well, that's very good, and that covers a whole lot of things that right there that we hadn't gotten in. So, so this guy, this Alonzo Mann that they convinced in the 1980s? But he was in his 80s.
1982, right? He gave the affidavit.
Yeah, and he was in his 80s already.
83 years old.
Yeah, and they said he was, in this thing I read, he said he was senile and in terrible health and on a whole bunch of medications and so on. I don't know. But, and the whole thing in itself is not convincing. So it's just an attempt by the Jews to come up with something that they play up in their media. See, they control the media. They play all this stuff up as being credible to continue in their effort to exonerate Leo Frank. And here in the... Frank's lead defense attorney was course, you already mentioned, I think, the governor's law partner and so on and so forth. But Slayton met with Lewis Marshall. You know, this is, I'm just bringing in these names because we've run into them in the International Jew so often. And, of course, Lewis Marshall, the head of the American Jewish Committee and all that, was very much involved in this. And he was Frank's attorney before the U.S. Supreme Court, it says. Okay, I hope that's right. And doubtless the most prominent leader of the American Jewish community at the time. And Slayton had controlled a large slush fund, which was doubtless contributed to by wealthy Jews. So he was very Jew-friendly, had Jews in his law practice, you said. And he needed this money to, in his campaign, his re-election campaign, to defeat this opponent, Dorsey. And it says that... this Steve Oney I'm going to talk about describes a very warm reception that Slayton received on his trip to New York. You already talked about that. Okay, and then, but you know, in the end, Slayton lost that. He lost that election to be a re-election for governor, and this Dorsey won, and he never ran for office again. He was kind of ruined. But, you know, it was so clear to the Georgians that Slayton did this for his own political benefit and to please his friends. And his Jewish friends, and this commutation of Frank's death sentence, and so you know, there's a lot of anger about that too.
Yeah, I have a paragraph from the New York Times here, the same article where they interviewed Nathaniel Harris, the governor that succeeded Slayton.
Okay.
It says a year or more ago, that would be a year or more before August 1915. Judge Morris called on Slayton to resign from the firm of Rosser, Brandon, Slayton, and Phillips, or else announce that he would leave Frank's case over for his successor. This and other things fostered the suspicion that Slayton intended to pardon Frank if the appeals to the various courts did not make it unnecessary. The last year of Slayton's term as governor was spent with thousands of eyes watching him with deep suspicion to see if the belief was justified. When all the appeals failed and Slayton did pardon Frank, it was of no use to argue with the men who had been expecting just such an act and had assigned it, and had assigned in their own minds an evil motive for it. So that's the New York Times on it.
That's very good. Very good. Yeah. So that makes it very plain. I believe that's good that he intended that all along. And I think he did it on the last day, that he was governor, on next to the last day of he was in office. He waited until then, and then he, pardoned, Frank. He didn't let him go, but he gave him a life sentence instead of, which he could appeal, you know, and he could keep trying to get out of prison. They commuted the death penalty. And then the next day he was out of office and he never even, well, he had already lost, you know, but his election. And he never, why should a governor who's already been denied re-election and somebody else is coming in be allowed to do something like that at the very last day that he's in office? You see, I guess it's legally okay, but it's not proper at all. Not at all, but that's what he did. So that's just another bad thing. Now, I would like to, in the little time we have left, to talk about how the Jews are functioning nowadays to try to keep this Frank innocence alive. And there's two people that are mentioned on this really good website, www.leofrank.org. And one is Steve Oney. Steve Oney, O-N-E-Y. He's Jewish, married to a Jewess also, and he's some kind of a journalist. And he wrote a book, which is supposed to be a very well-written book that sounds very neutral, you know, even kind of scholarly and like it's really been researched. And he doesn't come to a conclusion. This book came out in 2003, unless I'm wrong about that, but... I think so. And he pretends like the reviewer said that the book appears to be neutral, to take in all the facts and to leave it open, except that the guy believes, Steve Oney believes that Frank is innocent, but it will never be proven because it's his word against the black guy Connolly's word, and that's can't go anywhere from there. But all in all, he's probably innocent. Well, this, he says this is all just a big Jewish trick. The way they do things to make it out like, you know, like there is reason to think that, and that Frank really is a martyr, and there's, and that he leaves out all kinds of evidence. I'm in such a hurry here. I'm not going looking at it carefully, but he, okay, here's one thing. Under the veneer, Steve Oney is a pseudo historian practicing pseudo scholarship. His book is written in a style that gives it an air of fair and balanced scholarly neutrality. But when one takes a much closer look at the statements and claims within it and then compares them against the 2,000, you know, all the pages of the official court case, one discovers this book by Oney is nothing more than another Jewish con job, just like every other book written by Jews about the Leo Frank case. Well, most of the books written about the Leo Frank case are written by Jews. And another one is this Leonard Dinnerstein, whose book came out in, 19, he wrote an article, in 1968? Well, he was doing his dissertation at Columbia, and he did it on the Leo Frank case, and it turned into a book. It started first edition 1968. The last edition, 2008. So it's been a very popular book. And he does the same thing. Here's something on his hate crime hoax on page 110. Beyond the main testimony, this is what Dinnerstein writes. The jurors have a little more to go on. Well, I already said this, but that the courtrooms, the windows were left open, and you could hear the people outside shouting, crack the Jew's neck, lynch him, and that they had made threats against the jury. All that came from Dinnerstein. It's all lies. And then his central thesis is that anti-Semitism was responsible for an innocent Jewish man, Leo Frank, getting convicted for the murder of Mary Fagan, and so on. And it just, you know, that's just the way they present all this stuff. And there's nobody very much fighting, you know, writing the other way, or if they do their, you know, the Jews control the book publishing business too. So if you write a book, they won't either they won't publish it or they won't promote it. Now there's one more thing about what that I'm going to say, then I'll let you contribute. And that is these things that there was this. Where is that? There was this. I'm way past it. But there was a docudrama. I'm trying to find the details here. All right, a docudrama on TV. Oh, here we go. They did a musical was made about this trial called Parade, and it's got jingle-esque, catchy songs. And you can see it. Well, you find it on this website, but you can click on it and go there. I don't know if it's on YouTube or if you can buy a CD of you know, a disc on it, or what it is, but I could hardly believe they could make a musical called Parade, and then they had this fictionalized docudrama, People versus Leo Frank. I saw a picture of that.
That's the PBS
2009,
one.
Yeah, PBS. And, you know, it was Jack Lemmon was in there, and a bunch of people, and they had this Frank's wife, who was a rather unattractive, unfeminine-looking woman, stocky, and they have her as this beautiful, svelte, you know, glamorous woman and so on. The whole thing was just fake and phony, but they put that out, and then there's all the books, all of them taking creative artistic license to, to put forward their case. And that's what we're left with. And now this year, 2013, We've got the ADL going to make, wait till October. No, October's their anniversary. Well, I haven't seen them doing a whole lot, actually. Have you? I mean, they're still promoting the innocence of Leo Frank.
Sure. Sure. So, yeah, I saw the trailer for that PBS show, People versus Leo Frank, and there's a scene that they show in the trailer where somebody says, Leo Frank would never have been charged if he hadn't been a Jew. And that's just a flat-out lie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because now, you know, that has contributed to the kind of distrust of Jews that one would hope would be growing. I would hope it would be growing because I'm pretty tired of this, and I think that this is... Well, I don't know. Have we done a decent job of explaining how this is just a part of the whole Jewish agenda?
Oh, yeah, we covered the fact that there was no anti-Semitism in Georgia before the Leo Frank case, which means that he was not charged and convicted because he was a Jew.
Or as a matter of fact, Hattie, he was pardoned because he was a Jew. He was given every benefit because he was a Jew. So being a Jew helped him, didn't hurt him. It's just the opposite of what they say.
Yeah, well, that's an inference, you know, why Slayton pardoned him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if we can really...
Well, to satisfy his Jewish friends, he had all these Jews wanting him to do it. Yeah. You know, I do have this little ending thing. It's pretty strong, but I think I'll read it and then you can comment. You know, in Jews are actually, when you look at everything that the Jews are doing, and we can learn that in the International Jew, Jews are the scum of the earth. But they engage in their main activity to acquire wealth. This is all from compliments of Carolyn Yeager, okay? Their main activity to acquire wealth in order to use it to convince the rest of us to see them as the salt of the earth, not the scum of the earth, or the cream, you know, the best, the chosen. And we're under no order or prerogative to allow them to operate this scam in our societies. This is the thing. We do not owe them anything that they have ever done for us that they should be allowed to carry this out in our societies. It's self-abuse on our part. And if Christianity has a bad side for us, it is how Jews have used it to twist, distort beliefs that are meant to serve our own people, not all these other people, and not them, and our own brethren. And they've made a compelling case that this means them, that, well, we have to be nice to them if we're going to be Christian. And this is how they have taken Christianity and twisted it around. And what we should do is not blame and throw out Christianity. We should throw out the Jews. So you have the last word, Hanning.
Well, really what lets them get away with it is our individualism in this country and the fact that we place respect for private property above the needs of the community, because that's what allows the Jews to do whatever they want to do with whatever broadcast or media they own. They can perpetuate their lies, and it's just a matter of private property.
Well, being able to own all that they own is a big part of it. I agree. All right, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. I want to thank you for listening, and come back to us next week. This is Carolyn Ann Hattie saying good night.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.